a certain process that you have to go through to get married. Most of you know it. There's a process that you go through to get married. Also, to become a Mason. And while feeling does enter into the AA program, especially so far as this higher power is concerned, it's not all feeling. There is a process that you follow. A definite process, just as definite as going into the Masons and getting married. Emotional evidences of sobriety are not necessarily AA, is what I'm trying to get across. You've seen a great many who get sold on this program immediately and then immediately get drunk right afterwards, and you wonder how they could do it. Our feeling changes with our thinking or our faith. As my faith increases or decreases, so does my feeling increase or decrease for this higher power. Now, mind you, and I want to emphasize this, I don't say that one does not feel good because they're sober. And in AA, I merely say that because you're sober in AA, doesn't mean that your feelings are necessarily right until you get all of the program. I feel good because I'm sober in AA, but my sobriety is guaranteed even when I don't feel good. Like I am now with this cold. It's guaranteed when I don't feel good when I'm in AA. It's guaranteed when I sometimes get off of the program just a little bit, because I'm still connected with that higher power and I haven't blown a fuse. And if I do, I can always replace that fuse. Do feelings then really enter into or have any place in this second step? I'd say that it does, because AA certainly is not just a cold intellectual matter. If we were cold intellectual people, we never would have got drunk. But the feeling that I'm talking about that is necessary is a compulsion just as strong. It is a compulsion just as strong as that for alcohol, a compulsion to take this program. That's the feeling that is necessary in AA. And so you can see that correct thinking will lead a man to right feeling. If I think correctly on this program, I'll and study the program, I'll begin to feel right. Well, then how about this acting? Thinking and feeling alone doesn't make an AA. AA is an individual thing and not collective. Now I'm going to get into it. Somebody says that a while ago, if you come to 6 meetings, some of this will rub off. I didn't get my AA in meetings. I got it face to face, talking to people like Buck and you and other men and women. We have collective unity as we have now for individual purpose. That individual purpose is to maintain our individual sobriety. And I think if you sit down and figure your sobriety, you'll find that you got it because somebody else acted on you. They brought you the power face to face. I have sense enough to know, I don't care how great a speaker is, he can be as great as anybody, he will not reach over 50% of the people in any one audience. And as a rule, he won't reach over 20%. Well, you can see how much AA then a person is going to get in a room where there is just one or two speakers. Again, this acting in AA, even though you have all the power that you need in the second step, is not acting like a moral prude. I should say prune, maybe. Prude is what I mean. Cersei brought out last night as we were talking that the fourth step says to take a moral inventory and not an immoral one. I think he's right. Those were words of wisdom. If morality is all you have to stand on, I think it was Horace Mann that said that a man whose morality is his best suit were best naked. And a great deal in AA sometimes is just a criticism of other folks because we ourselves have suddenly become moral, which is a new experience to a great many of us. Remember that in AA, in this acting, we can only help one another. I can only help you, and you can only help me individually. I've been around long enough now so that when I need help, and quite often I do, I get in my car, get in on the train or on a bus, and go to the individual that I feel can help me the most right at that time, thereby guaranteeing my sobriety. Remember that we can only help one another in enacting in conformance with this power spoken of in the second step. That acting becomes necessary then for you to help me and me to help you. But remember, if I don't think right and if I don't feel right, I won't act right. Some people say, well, I don't feel like doing any 12-step work. Well, you aren't. Either your thinking or your feeling is wrong someplace. Remember, too, on that second step, that if you're going to stand before your fellow AAs, you've come to believe in that power that's greater than yourself, and he has restored you to sanity. If you're going to believe in God, you have to kneel before God. And don't be ashamed of it. Yesterday, coming down the road, three of us, in an automobile, talking about one thing that I couldn't get three men in my congregation gathered to talk about, and they're all good men. The answer to the prayers that had been uttered by those men. It was a wonderful thing. I got to thinking, well, I don't have three other men of my acquaintance outside of AA in my own congregation that have sat here and talk about the answer to their prayers as these men are talking. And the only reason they're doing it is because they had the second step. They'd actually come to believe in that power, and that power was so close to them. And I'm going to close with how close it is. I found out that God and the closeness of that power is not a matter of altitude, but with me and other AAs, it's just a matter of attitude. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Tim. When I first came to AA, I've told some of you this, but I felt about it in this way, that I had tried everything and nothing seemed to work, that is, to make me quit drinking. So I felt somewhat like the man in the story in the New Testament felt. He was a leper, and he had heard that there was a great teacher who could cure diseases. So he came to this teacher and asked him to be cured of leprosy. And the man gave him a very peculiar instruction. He said, you go dip seven times in the River Jordan. Now, I can imagine I'm changing this story a bit to fit our type of thinking and to fit these times. I can imagine that this man said, what goes on here? There could be no river dirtier than the Jordan. And I have a disease of leprosy, which is a filthy, loathsome disease, and the only result of dipping seven times in the Jordan can be that I'll come out dirtier than when I went in. But the man gave a second thought to it, and he said, well, what the hell can I lose? I'm a leper anyhow, and maybe the man will help me. So he went and dipped seven times in the River Jordan, and we're told, according to the story, that he came out healed of his leprosy. Well, that's the way I felt when I approached AA. What could I lose? I'd tried everything else, and much to my surprise, it worked. I have on this platform here today some of my best friends. One of the very best friends that I have anywhere is going to talk to you next. When I first came into AA, I heard about this man who was located in Longview and who had been practicing the principles of AA by having the big book before we ever started a group in this section. So I want Doc to talk to you now.
My name is Doc Wormley, and I am definitely an alcoholic. Through following the AA program and the help of people like you and the help of God, I haven't had a drink in 7 years, 7 months, and 8 days. I thought, maybe, when I agreed to be on the program, that I would take some other phase of my alcoholic problem and try to show it to you in a different sort of way. But when I talked to MacFarlane, he says, "Doc, if you eliminate your case history," he said, "these people won't think you've ever been an alcoholic." He said, "you being a dentist, they'll say, well, that guy went to some doctor and he got a mysterious shot of some kind of drug that sobered him up. Hell, he's never had any trouble." So to prove to you that I've had trouble, and to go back to the starting, according to the psychiatrist, and y'all can take that for whatever you want to, the trouble started because of a divorce that was gotten by my mother and father. In turn, they gave me to my grandmother and grandfather to raise. And the psychiatrist version of the thing is that the love and the affection that I should have found an outlet for through my mother and father went screwy, and I, in turn, had a maladjusted personality. That's good enough for me. It don't make any difference how it happened. It happened. Now, we'll take back up until I was 14 or 15 years old. I didn't have very much trouble. I was reared in a small town out in West Texas. Romped around and chewed tobacco and things that kids do in those small towns. And didn't give very much consideration to my capabilities or to my personality or my judgment or my common sense. And the personality worked very well. I didn't notice any trouble much. Along about the time I was 15 years old, something happened. I got terribly disinterested in school and went one whole year and didn't pass the subject. Well, that was a signal to my parents that there was something wrong with me, and they moved to Waco to send me to school down there, thinking maybe that I would get interested in things there and do better. Well, the first year down there, I realized just how inadequate I was, and I wanted to do something about it. I realized even that early that I needed some kind of development that I wasn't getting. Well, I tried to associate with some boys there that probably had had a little more material things than I had, and they weren't too interested in me. And like most of us alcoholics are, I said, "the hell with that." But way down deep, I blamed my family for my trouble. I told myself that if they had given me the proper home and those kind of things, that I wouldn't be the kind of person that I was. The next year, the trouble really hit me. That winter, I got extremely nervous. Heartbeat was 120 a minute. Lost weight. I was nearly as tall as I am now. Dropped off to 117 pounds. And I had a hell of a time. The psychiatrist, if he had a hold of me then, he would have found a deep sense of guilt, extreme anxiety, and an inability to make a decision what I was going to do. Of course, there wasn't any psychiatrist then, and there wasn't any AA, and there wasn't anything to turn to. But I managed it out that winter in school, and didn't do very much good, but got by. And decided that a little farming might help the condition. So I went out in West Texas and worked on a farm. That seemed to help me. I guess I got away from the friction. Larger town, maybe things that kind. And the personality made some kind of an adjustment. It wasn't good. Still, it wasn't too bad. And if a psychiatrist was describing this thing, he would say that I passed from an acute condition into a chronic condition. He would tell you that if he had gotten me when I had my acute attack, that it would have been very simple to treat, and that I wouldn't have had much trouble overcoming my disability. But going on for 24 years, it was hard to treat. Now, during those 24 years, I went to over 50 medical men. Being a dentist, they took a very, very great interest in me and tried to help me. There was one thing that they were all agreed on, was that there wasn't anything physically the matter with me. But there I was, dragging around, unhappy as hell, no energy, and bored stiff. And the only time I got any relief from it was when I'd crawl off and get drunk. And Buck over here fits in the picture now. He was out at Sweetwater, and I went out there to make my home. Well, Buck had some stuff out there he called Harmony Shaving Lotion. And we proceeded to get harmonized. And boy, it was wonderful. And I graduated from Harmony on into Jake, Ed Bernard, Lyco, and Forrest, and all those old things that you used to drink when you couldn't get whiskey. Of course, we had lots of corn whiskey, and we drank lots of that. I tell you these things to show you that whiskey don't help the condition, and that whiskey wasn't what was wrong with me. I had a maladjusted personality, and I was trying to adjust it with alcohol, and it can't be done. And there aren't any drugs that will adjust it, because I've had all of those. The medical men have tried everything in the book on me. I've had them to give me insulin shot, and then bring me out of it with glucose, and all those things. None of it did any good. Another treatment that I put on myself was exercise. I thought that would do it. I'd build myself up physically. I lifted weights. I ran. I got to where I could run 2 miles and a half. And none of that did any good. Finally, in desperation, I went to Dr. Van Sickle, a friend of mine in Longview. And I said, "Dr. Van, I got to have some help." And he said, "Well, I don't know where you're going to get it." And I said, "Don't you know any nerve men in the country and anybody treating nerves?" He says, "Well, Schwankenberg treats them up there in Dallas." I said, "Well, that's for me." So in the meantime, I'd gotten hold of lots of things that psychiatrists write. And of course, being a educated in medicine, I'd studied a lot of medical work. So when I got up there to talk to Schwankenberg, he said, "Well," said, "I think you understand your trouble pretty well. I don't have anything out there at the hospital I think could help you except some of those electric shock treatments." So he said, "I advise you to take some of them. They may help you and they may not, but they won't hurt you, or they won't make you any worse." And I said, "Well, I can't do that." So I took 6 of those. You take them in Paris. I'd get on train in Longview and go to Dallas and take one on Monday. Come back and work in my office on Tuesday and go back Thursday and take one of those shock treatments. Well, I believe they helped. I think that they shook out a lot of that old morbid thinking and sense of guilt and things like that, got that some of that out of my subconscious mind and gave me a chance to supplant it with some straight thinking. I think that's where they work, in the way they work. Then along about that time, this article came out in Look magazine on AA. And I got it, read it, and sent up to New York and got the big book. And I've been practicing the AA program ever since. I didn't achieve any happiness much over there out of the program until we got the group started. You have to have the group. You can stay sober, but it sure does help to have the fellows around you and be able to talk to them and know that they understand you. And that's about all I have to say.
Thank you very much, Doc. I believe Doc qualified himself pretty well as an alcoholic. I think you folks will all agree with me on that. There are hundreds of people in this section of the country who owe their sobriety, at least in part, to Doc. And I think it's wonderful what he's been able to do. Now we're going to throw in another one of those AA extras. And this is a good one. Quite a few months ago, I happened to be in Houston. I go down there quite regularly in my business. And, of course, I attend the groups when I'm down there. And there was a tall, gray-headed, rangy old boy handling the coffee bar at the Montrose Club there in Houston that I became fairly well acquainted with. I was very much impressed by the sincerity with which he went about the AA program. And I've come to know him pretty well. And I want to say to him right now that to have known him this long and to have seen the great progress that he has made has been a distinct honor to me. As I look around this room, I see hundreds of people who have done a far better job than I have in AA. And to associate with those people and to see what they're doing has been a big help to me. And that certainly is true of Peck. And I'm going to ask him to come up and talk to us now.
Thank you, Troy. That step I just stumbled on there then is a wooden step. The one that's bothered me the most for the last year or so has been the 13th step. To say that I'm happy to be here is just words. I am Peck Warren, a determined alcoholic. It took me 31 years to prove that to myself. By the grace of and the faith in a God that I figured out for myself alone, I've been sober, without alcohol or goofballs, which I was very fond of, 1 year, 7 months, 13 days. I must always remind myself that I am the living example of a miracle. I started serious drinking at the age of 16. I'll not burden you with a story because it ain't pretty. There are some here in this audience that saw me the first day I came to Montrose in Houston. They shook their heads and said, well, I hope so. They gave him a chance, about like a one-armed man at a paper-hanging contest. I had in my heart and on my mind an idea that a drink wasn't the answer. And if I would begin to tell you some of the things that have happened to me in a year and a half, I might be accused, and rightfully so, of seeking sympathy. If I want that, I'll go to the dictionary and find it on page 241 under the SYM. I had a lot of that for myself, and it helped me to stay drunk. I know that my pattern of drinking was no different from the others. As Joe said early in the day, he was a Roman drunk. Well, I was a Roman drunk, and I was a Romeo, always without a Juliet. There may be some people here in this audience that personally don't like me. I'm afraid of that. But I'll tell you one thing. Bless their heart, that's all they can do is just don't like me. They can't hurt me. I'm not mad at anybody. There's so many things that I'd like to tell you this evening, and it can all be summed up and boiled down to this. God is my keeper. My cup is full. Everything good that comes to me will come to me primarily because I'm sober. All things that were good in my life past during my drinking pattern, I messed up because of drink. Everything that was bad, I made it worse by the same token. I've heard our friend Troy say that he didn't follow the pattern of prosperity to a great extent. He don't hold an individual right to that. My first year of sobriety, I had 9 jobs from Houston to Chicago. So that part of it is set. I'm now prosperous because I have a faith that keeps me comparatively happy, content. As far as money is concerned, I have a speaking acquaintance with it. I say to money, hello there, and it says to me, bye now. When I find so many added dividends in the simple process of staying sober. I met a man here this morning that I was in the, shall we say, Goonie cage in Waco. They told us over there that those irons on the window were not bars. We would look upon them as decorated grills. One fellow says to me, he says, now don't get the idea that you're a prisoner here. Oh, I said, not me. Oh, no. I just want to walk down to the corner and mail a letter. Just couldn't do that. But as far as medical science and psychiatry is concerned, I've had the best. I remember it hasn't been too long ago when I was in the Naval Hospital in Norfolk, Virginia. They were glad I got out of there, too. Dr. Lawrence Cobb asked me if I saw any squirrels out that window, and I told him I did. Well, he said, I know. What's the matter with you? Well, I'm going to tell you one thing, doctor. If you don't see any squirrels, you better give me that rubber hammer, and you go get in my bunk. They're sure as hell there. And they were there. But just let me be to the point of saying to you that when I first came to AA in Houston, and those people that are here that saw me there, let me say to you all that I came to find some of the lineament that Oscar Wren, Jack Nash, Bill McClendon, and boys that I'd known a lifetime were using for their aches and pains. Whatever it was, I sure wanted some up. Up to now, by the grace of God, I have remained dry, if not sober. The road ahead looks a whole lot brighter, but I must glance back once in a while across that trail of devastated trials and remember that my ship has come in many times, but I was asleep on the dock and didn't receive the cargo. So as I go from you this evening, believe me, the grace of God, you go in my heart.
That's why I say that I've been very proud to watch Peck's progress. Now we're going to digress just 1 minute also to pay a little honor to someone that deserves honor. We don't have a formal program always at AA, and I want Lou Garvin, the secretary of the Downtown Club in Fort Worth, to stand just a moment. I understand this is your second birthday, and we want to give you sincere greetings and tell you how proud we are for you. Now, while we're speaking of Fort Worth, you know, I'm from Dallas. So sometimes we don't talk too kindly of Fort Worth, but in the AA sense, there's always been a very close feeling between the clubs in Dallas and the Fort Worth clubs in AA. So we have a representative from Fort Worth on this program tonight, And we're very glad to have Harry G. with us. And I'm going to ask him to talk to you at this time.
You know, this has been a mighty fine meeting and a wonderful program up to this point. But I'm sure that we tire of good things as others, so I'm going to say about the most interesting thing I have to say first, and that is that I'm going to be very brief. I'm Harry Green. I'm an alcoholic. By attempting to follow the 12 steps of the AA program as I personally understand and interpret them, by constant attendance at AA meetings, doing my part as much as I can, with the help of a power greater than myself, I've been dry 4 years, 2.5 months. I said I was an alcoholic. This happens to be one of the towns in the state that I have legal record proof of that. I'll not tell you my story, excepting that 16 years ago this summer, I was coming into the fair city of Tyler. I was mixing whiskey and gasoline. I was driving a 12-cylinder Cadillac, and I had $600 cash in my pocket. Nothing wrong with me. The world was rosy. But I met a big truck out here. I had a head-on collision. Thank God I didn't kill anybody, and I didn't get hurt myself. But a few moments thereafter, a couple of representatives of your sheriff's office came out to see me. And they escorted me down here to the stone building. And they started upstairs with me. And I told them they couldn't put a man in jail that was driving a Cadillac and had money. But they did. Not long thereafter, one of the district judges called me before him. He sent some men to get me, as a matter of fact. And he told me that in order to protect the citizens of Smith County from me, he found it necessary to send me out to the pea patch for 90 days. Brother, that was an experience. That's how I was greeted here 16 years ago. This morning, I dropped by the office of one of your better-known attorneys here in town, a man that I've had some professional contact with and whom I admire very much. I went by to congratulate him on his recent appointment to the federal judgeship. I'm speaking of Joe Sheehy here. And in conversation, we knew one another well enough to do a little kidding about a case we was interested in. And he said, "What are you doing over here, Green?" And rather flippantly, I said, "Well, I'm over here attending this convention of ex-drunks." He says, "You are?" He said, "Well, I know about that." He says, "That's a wonderful thing that you boys are doing." And he spoke most highly and most complimentary of AA. And in speaking of AA, I inferred that he was complimenting me. And as I left his office and went down the elevator and walked directly over here, I thought how differently that judge has received me as compared with the judge 16 years ago. I know of no other incident that better typifies the difference in my life during my drinking days and my days in AA. You can apply that to any phase of my life that you wish, and it's been an improvement. I now have respect where I had no friends. I have peace of mind where I had nothing but worries. There were times, yes, when I thought that because I had a big automobile and a little money in my pocket, I thought I was on top of the world, but I wasn't happy. Right now, if I had nothing but an old battered Ford and 30 cents in my pocket, and I had AA, I'd be a whole lot better satisfied than I was 16 years ago. Now, there's been a lot of very serious talks here, and if I can, I want to inject just a little bit of humor in this thing. There's been several references to stinking thinking here today. Earl this morning, and our good friend from Belton a while ago, and it reminds me of the story of a man who did not have the ability to think through. Some of you heard this before, I know, because I told it. Lady out in the country, where they hung their clothes out on the lines, you know, told her husband one day she wanted him to go out and cut her a clothesline pole. Something to prop up that sagging line in the middle. So he gets his hand axe, and he goes out into the woodlot, and he finds a sapling of about the right length and the right size, and he cuts it off, and he brings it back, and he sets it under the clothesline pole, under the clothesline. And he looks up at the top of it, and he noted that he had failed to cut a notch up there. The pole was standing there, yes, there was no wind, but he couldn't reach the top of that pole standing on the ground, and that presented quite a problem to him. How was he going to cut a notch there? So he went across the street to his neighbors and asked if they had a stepladder. No, he didn't have a stepladder. What do you want of it, John? Well, he told the neighbor his problem. The neighbor said, well, that's easy. He said, you live in a two-story house. He said, just go over there and get the pole and set it up alongside the house. And he said, go upstairs and reach out the window, and you can cut a notch in the top of that pole easily. You know, that's typical of the alcoholic. If there's a long way around a problem or a hard way to do it, we'll do it. We can't see with our limited ability to think, confused with alcohol, we can't ever come to the point. Now, at various times over the state, I have read to audiences what I might call the 12 steps of AA in reverse. And by the special request of three or four people here today, I'm going to read them again. These are always good for a laugh. And I think it's good in AA when we can laugh, because that's one of the signs of recovery. That shows we're not taking ourselves too seriously. And I think one of the worst things that could happen to us if we got to the point where we took ourselves too seriously in our newfound sobriety. It happens, I think, that I've seen in this convention today, the two men who I believe wrote these things, I found them on a bulletin board out in Los Angeles, California, and brought them back to Texas, thought I had something new. I've since scattered them from coast to coast. Step number one, I stated I could hold my liquor and was master of my life. Step number two, believed I was sane and rational in every respect. Step number three, decided to run my life and be successful in all my undertakings. And step number four, made a thorough and searching inventory of my fellow man and found him lacking. Number five, admitted to no one, including God and myself, that there was anything wrong with me. Number six, sought through alcohol to remove my responsibilities. Number seven, this is a dilly, got drunk to remove these shortcomings. Number eight, made a list of all persons who had harmed me, whether real or imaginary, and swore to get even. Number nine, got even whenever possible, except when to do so would further injure me. Number ten, continued to find fault with the world and the people in it, and when I was right, promptly admitted it. Number 11, sought through lying, cheating, and stealing to improve myself materially at the expense of my fellow man, asking only for the means to get drunk and stay drunk. And number 12, after having had a complete moral, physical, and financial breakdown as a result of this kind of living, I tried to drag those who were dear to me down to my level and practice these reasonings in all my affairs. It certainly would not be possible for anybody but an alcoholic to have conceived those 12 steps in reverse. And it's the truest 12 steps that I have ever seen any place. I've seen various other parodies and takeoffs on them. But it's the truest 12 steps that I ever saw, by which I used to live before I found AA. Now, I haven't heard anything said so far today. I have missed one of these sessions here. About the ladies we have present. You've heard a lot said today about the benefit to we AAs, to we alcoholics. And of course, that's primarily why we're here, because we are alcoholics. But there's others in our family, our wives, or in the vice versa, the husband. And there are children to be remembered. And I wouldn't want to close my part of this program without bringing that thought to your mind. I could say, from my observation, the benefits that I've seen derived by families, but the words at my command are not nearly as good as the words of a little girl down in Houston, Texas, who on the occasion of her father's first birthday, I believe it was, when she was a teenage girl in school, she composed a poem to her father. I happened to be at the Richmond group that night, and I later asked for a copy of that. And like these 12 steps, I have read this poem from coast to coast. And I'm going to close my part by reading the words of little Janie Capson, the daughter of as good an AA as you'll find down in Houston. She entitles it, My Debt to AA. People often ask me, what does AA mean to you? If I started enumerating, I never would get through. But I'll attempt to answer in the best way that I know what AA has done for me and what to AA I owe. I owe the love I have for Dad now that he doesn't drink. I owe my good school grades because I've now begun to think. I owe my self-sufficiency. I've learned to stand up tall and say, there goes my dad, you kids. He's the best dad of them all. Now, I never was ashamed of him. Oh, no, I couldn't be, because there never was a man half as sweet as he. It's just I didn't realize that he was sick all through. You've taught me consideration. That's one thing I owe to you. I owe my carefree, happy way I haven't had in quite a while. I owe all this because, you see, I now can laugh and smile. And so my heart is filled with joy whenever I stop and think that for the year Dad's been in AA, he hasn't had a drink. So here's my thanks to Dad and AA for the swell job they have done. And thanks to the part his friends did play in the battle I'm sure is won. It's been a pleasure to appear before you folks. I thank you for listening.
Thank you very much, Harry, for those fine remarks. Doc was talking about Swinkenberg's. I also am an alumni of Swinkenberg's. I went out there to be dehydrated. The boss sent me out there. And there's one thing that they did for me at Beverly Hills Sanitarium. Of course, I came out feeling fit physically. But the thing that they did for me was to sick AA on me. When I got ready to leave, Dr. Winkenberg called me in and gave me 10 minutes of his time. He said, son, says, you look like an ordinarily sensible young man. Why, young man, I like that too. He said, why don't you quit drinking? And I said, Doc, you're the psychiatrist, you answer that. Well, he says, now I'm going to tell you, I can't make you quit drinking. And I said, well, Doc, if you can't make me quit drinking, why in the hell didn't you tell me that before I spent $150 out here? He said, well, I'll give you something that's worth $150. I know how you can quit. You go to Alcoholics Anonymous, and they'll make you give you a program where you can quit. And so it was well worth the $150. Fortunately, he didn't leave it up to me. He also called Esther, whom we all know, and she got a man on me, and he chased me down and drugged me by the ear to Alcoholics Anonymous. So I'm not going to make a speech on the physical well-being that comes from Beverly Hills Sanitarium, but I am going to say that bringing me to AA was well worth the $150 that was spent on me out there. Now, I don't know whether he knows this or not, but our next speaker has always been an inspiration to me. The type of work he has done for AA may not be reflected on the ledger sheets to his credit here in this world, but it will be for all time to come because he has done a wonderful piece of work in his hometown of Nacogdoches and in the section around that vicinity. So now I'm going to call on Claude H. to talk to us.
Troy said he had a host of good speakers, and up to now he has. I think he must have me up here as an example. I can't understand any other reason than the shuffle they got me mixed up with the speakers. I once got a letter that read something like this: Dear Claude, the Reverend John Smith, who is now in prohibition work, has a living example on his stage, Herman, a swollen-faced, bleary-eyed drunkard who sits there as a bad example for people who drink. It is a sad thing to tell you that poor Herman is passed. But I'm also happy to say that I'm authorized to offer you Herman's job. The salary will be $25 a month and all the whiskey you can drink. Boy, did that burn me up. I had no idea where it came from, but it cut me pretty deep. It had no effect on my drinking, however. I continued that. My name is Claude, and by following this program, trying to live the 12 steps, and by the help of a lot of good AAs, I've been sober 5 years and 9 days. Constant vigilance is my only safeguard. I'm not one of those that can say that I never wanted to drink. There isn't a day passes that I wouldn't take a drink if I thought I could. And there are days when I think that I can get along without a drink. But after 6 years in AA, and about 5 slips the first year in a hospital siege every time, I was convinced, and I am still convinced, that I can't take a drink. And when people tell you that length of sobriety is not a restraint to drinking, they're mistaken. I wouldn't throw 5 years in the ash can over a trivial matter of getting drunk. And I still don't say that they couldn't put enough heat on me to make me get drunk. I haven't quit drinking. I never will quit drinking. I've quit drinking today. But I'll never say that I quit drinking. Because I see too many people in 30 days get up and say, I found the answer and I'm through. In a very short time, they were drunk. I quit drinking every morning, and I have for 5 years. And I'm going to continue to quit drinking every morning. And I thank God every night that I stayed sober for that day. To AA, I'm very grateful. AA has meant everything to me. It's the only thing that's ever meant anything in my life. I like the fellowship in AA. I'm only worried that the fellowship in AA is waning. I never had a brother or sister, but when I came into AA, I felt closer, I believe, to the AAs that I came in contact that could have a brother or sister. But I was talking to Vic a while ago, and it seems that some of the AAs coming in now are not placing the value on AA that I placed when I came in it. I don't know whether they've been hurt bad enough. I don't know what's happened to them. Maybe they're too young. Maybe they haven't been dragged through hell by the hair of their head. I don't know. But they just don't seem to have the enthusiasm. They don't seem to have the appreciation for AA that I had when I came into it. I was looking for it. Nobody brought me in. I looked for them. I wanted something. And I found it in AA. And I'm going to try to keep it. And the fellowship in AA will help me keep it. That brotherly feeling. I used to look forward to Thursday night. I knew that Doc, Bill, and Tommy and that bunch would be in my home that night. We were going to have AA meeting. I was thrilled. I couldn't wait till night came. We didn't quit at 9 o'clock. We talked till 2:30 in the morning sometimes. We confessed our faults one to another. We told each other our troubles. We had no speakers. We didn't know what a speaker was. Horace Port's the first man I ever heard speak. Spoke to 11 people in the courthouse. But we studied the 12 steps. We took 3 tonight, 3 next Thursday night, the next 3 the following Thursday night, and we continually pounded each other's head that we couldn't take that first drink. And by doing that, we convinced ourselves that we couldn't take that first drink. And I'll always be grateful to AA. I'm certainly proud of Tyler for what they've done. I want to congratulate them on the effort they've made in respecting the anonymity of the speakers. I'm an AA who still likes to reserve the right to tell people I'm an AA instead of having other people tell them. And at the proper time, in the proper place, I'm not a bit ashamed. In fact, I'm proud to tell them I'm an AA. But I reserve the right to do that myself, and I think the anonymity of Alcoholics Anonymous is a very big part of the program.
I think it brings us closer together. I think it creates a fellowship that nothing else in the world can do. And I hope we can continue to have that fellowship. And I just humbly and all, with all the humility at my command, thank God for a clearer and greater understanding which has been opened up to me through the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. Those dark clouds that hovered over me for so long now reflect the bronze ray of the sun, become a glorious background and rich the sunset of my life. And I'm very happy, and I'm happy to be here. I believe that's all.
Thank you very much, Claude. One of our speakers was not able to be here, at least I don't believe he is. Is Dan W. in the room anywhere? He's one of my very best friends, and his life means a lot to me. I'm sorry he couldn't be here. At this time, we'll hear from Bob K. from La Mesa.
I'm Bob, an alcoholic, and by the grace of God, in attempting to practice what I've learned in AA and association with people like you, I've been dry 3 years, 4 months, and 2 days today. I don't know, there's a lot of people here that I might need to qualify myself as an alcoholic, but in West Texas, where I live, there's no need for me to qualify myself. All the laws out there in Union. I was born in West Texas and became an alcoholic, the first drink of whiskey I ever took. I like the taste of it. I like what it'd do to me. How it made me feel. And those boys out there were pretty considerate to me. They didn't throw me in jail many times. But at one time, I had my driver's license taken away. That was a little inconvenient. But the city police in Big Spring took my driver's license away and told me that if they ever caught me driving in town, that the consequences would be a little bad. And Dawson County is a dry county. Howard County, I could drive in Howard County because I knew the sheriff pretty well. He wouldn't bother me till I got in the city limits. It was a city car. And the liquor store was about a mile from the city limits. I've got a horse that everybody out there calls Whiskey. So I'd load that old pony and drive to the city limits and unload him and go get my whiskey and come back. And when I came, when AA slipped up on me, I didn't want AA. It kind of snuck up on my blind side. I was sick, couldn't have any fun drinking. And a friend of mine there in Mesa that I knew was as bad as I was had been gone. He was one of these boys that'd get drunk and disappear. You wouldn't see him for 2 or 3 weeks. I didn't think much about it. I didn't tell him one morning and asked him if he wanted to drink. He said, no, he wasn't drinking today. I kind of scratched my head a little and thought, well, I'll get him to go with me. He'll take one drink. Morning company, I was lonesome. I drank 2 pints of whiskey waiting for him to take that first drink. And he laid the proposition to me about going to Seminole, trying some of Toombs' creamers over there. I didn't much like that because, alcoholic like, I thought it might interfere with my drink. Well, I thought about it several times in the next 2 weeks and finally told him that I believe that If he'd come by my house the next morning at 9:30, I'd go. By 4, I was awake and ready. By the time he got there at 9, I was fast gone. He loaded me in the car and started off, and I come to. Had to go by the ranch, sir. Couldn't leave to be gone very long without going by there. I went by there and detoured around by Midland, Odessa, which is about 200 miles out of the way to get to Seminole. By the time I got to Seminole, to the hospital, I didn't care whether I stayed or didn't. It didn't make any difference to me. I stayed that night, still never promising to stay any longer. But the next day, I wasn't able to leave. I couldn't get out of bed. And when I walked out of that hospital, after staying there 10 days, I had no more idea of staying sober than I did when I went in. I was feeling better physically, sure. But I thought I'll put another drunk off for about 10 days and I'll get to feeling good enough that, hell, I can have a little fun before I get sick. And for a period of time, that 90 days about, I had no idea at all of staying sober. I just, by the grace of God, me and the whiskey and the opportune time didn't get together. But some of the things that I heard that helped me during that 90 days, that finally soaked in on me. I got a lot of understanding at that hospital that I'd never gotten anywhere. And the people that came in there to visit seemed to understand my problem and want to help me. The other people that I'd been around didn't know how to help me, or they didn't have any faith in me. I certainly didn't have any in myself. After I got to thinking about it, those people gave me a little hope that maybe I could stay sober. And by living on that hope for a while, I finally got a little faith. A little faith and confidence back in myself. Because I could make a small decision. And after trying that a while, not being able to practice the easy does it part of the program, I still can't do that too good. But when we first get on this program, to me, that easy does it is one of the most important things there is. Because without it, we're going to hurry the program and not get what we and our alcoholic nature are looking for and as quick as we want. And we're liable to get disappointed. And when we get disappointed, why, we're liable to reach to that jug again. But after staying on the program a while and living on this hope and faith, I finally got humble enough to admit that I was wrong. That my idea of going back and drinking, I couldn't do it. I never had been able to. And when I got some humility mixed up with that hope and faith, it hit me. And I began to feel like that I was accomplishing something. Being able to walk down the street and look my fellow man in the face again. I never was able to do that. Even when I was a kid in high school, I couldn't do it. Because I always had a guilty conscience about something. I was afraid of something. Afraid of something that I didn't know what I was afraid of. And then finally I got sincere with myself and admitted down deep in my heart that I couldn't take another drink anytime, anywhere. It didn't make any difference. Whether I was at home or whether I was in Kalamazoo, that I couldn't take that drink with you, that I wouldn't be fooling anybody but myself, and that that was the guy I had to live with. And then, after a period of that living that away, I finally got grateful about what he had done to me and what it had to offer. And I hope that I can continue to be grateful and keep that sincerity and humility so that I can have my sobriety, which means more to me than anything today. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Bob. We're not doctors and lawyers or psychiatrists. We're just ordinary drunks who have found a way out. And I think nothing helps us so much as to listen to the story of what has happened to people whom God has touched through Alcoholics Anonymous. I wouldn't exactly say that I saved the best for the last, but I saved one of the best for the last. I spent a bit of time today between meetings talking to our next speaker and his fine wife, and I got a real inspiration from it, and I know you're going to enjoy very much hearing Buck talk to you now.
It's five bells. I'm honestly not going to talk but a minute, or else 28, I don't know which. I'm Buck Harbison, and I'm an alcoholic. With the help of just such people as you, and a power higher than me, and this program right straight down the middle, I've been sober 4 years and 8 months. I graduated from a college in this town with the request of the president in 1917. Just like I graduated from everything else. Never in my life have I ever graduated from anything except a nut house. I went to all the schools, and in 1917 I was here, and it was not on account of my drinking, but I was doing something that was detrimental to the school, and the man wrote my father to come after me. He was trying to make a commercial man out of me. I was going to the Tyler Commercial College, after having failed in some others. And you know, he did make a commercial man out of me. He and the jug. I got my first inspiration there. In 1945, I wound up a commercial drinker on every freight train in the country. I'm so very appreciative of the treatment that I've received down here. You know, I have never met a bad AA. Neither have I ever met a bad AA group or been associated with any AA group. And I join them just as fast as I hit the town. If I stay here till Sunday, I'll join you babies. I'm not going to dwell into anything. There's nothing that I can say about the AA program that'll possibly help anybody here. You've heard the finest talks, I believe, that I've ever heard, and you're in store for some more. I didn't come down here to hear a lot of AA. Honestly, I didn't. What I come for is gonna come off tonight. At 10 o'clock tonight, the music starts. I'm as light on my feet as a sweet evening breeze. I learned to dance 4 years and 8 months ago.